For nearly two decades, the Environment Report and its predecessor, the Great Lakes Radio Consortium, have been reporting about invasive species on Michigan radio. More and more kinds of pests are being introduced into the lakes, often by cargo ships bringing in critters from foreign ports. A new book is coming out. Its title, Lake Invaders, Invasive Species and a Battle for the Future of the Great Lakes. It was written by William Rapay, who joins us now. With the rate of new invasive species, you could publish an update, a revision of this book every other year. Why do you think we are still seeing so many introductions when we know most of the ways they're coming in and most of the ways we end up spreading them to inland lakes and rivers?
Thank you for having me, Lester. We're not really seeing that many new introductions coming in through ballast water. It's been, I want to say 9 years. I'm not sure that that's the right number. For the past decade or so, both the Canadian and U.S. Coast Guards have been requiring international ships to exchange their ballast water at sea.
Yeah, it's called swish and spit.
Exactly. Yeah. The whole idea behind ballast water is if a ship is traveling across the ocean, they want to make sure that their ballast tanks are filled with water in order to keep the ships steady. So you fill up your ballast tanks when you're empty with cargo, you fill it up with water in a port, you travel across the ocean, and you dump that water in the new port when you are filling up with cargo. So now the Coast Guards require the ships to empty their ballast water in the middle of the ocean and pick up salt water. And that process of transferring from freshwater to salt water is called osmotic shock, and it kills about 99% of all the organisms in a ballast tank. So that's been very effective, but there are other pathways.
Right, and it's not completely effective, because there's sediment in the bottom of those ballasts sometimes and things can hide in there. But talk about some of these other ways that we're seeing invasives coming in.
Well, one of the ways that really surprised me and was surprisingly close to home was through classrooms. My own daughter, when she was in third grade, had rusty crayfish in their classroom in a science unit. And I haven't talked to the teacher, but I know that the teacher sent some of those crayfish home with students. They wanted them as pets. And I suspect that the parents, when those crayfish came home, the parents took one look at them and said, I don't want that thing in my house. And since I live in Grosse Pointe, I would imagine that the parents probably thought that they were doing the humane thing and took them down and put them in Lake St. Clair.
And this happens with not just rusty crayfish, but a lot of aquariums where there are exotics in them and they don't want the fish anymore or the seaweed or whatever that's in it. And it gets dumped in some body of water and there's another problem.
Absolutely. Once again, close to home, I have a nursery near my house in Grosse Pointe where last fall I went in and I found that nursery selling water hyacinth and water lettuce, which are both popular pond plants. But they are both illegal to sell in the state of Michigan. The legislature has outlawed the possession and sale of those plants because of the impact that they would have on the Great Lakes. But yet they were for sale right there down the street from my house, which was a real surprise.
I want to talk about the poster child for invasive species, the Asian carp. A lot of people know about that threat, but they're unaware of quagga mussels, which have had a vast impact on the lake, spiny water fleas, round gobies, and so on. What could be done to get people as agitated about these pests as the ones like fish that jump out of the water?
Well, I suspect it has to do with people actually seeing impacts. I have a lot of friends of mine who are anglers, and I know that they can no longer catch fish like walleye in Lake St. Clair because the water clarity level of Lake St. Clair has changed dramatically over the past 10 years because of the impact of zebra mussels and quagga mussels. They're filter feeders. They suck the plankton out of the water. It makes the water clear. A lot of people look at that water and say, "Oh, look how clear the water is. I can see to the bottom. The water must be great." Something's missing now, and that's the plankton. And because the walleye don't like that really bright, clear water, they have moved on. They've moved on to the eastern basin of Lake Erie. They've moved down to Saginaw Bay and Lake Huron. So people in my neighborhood can no longer catch a walleye in Lake St. Clair and parts of the Detroit River. In order to get people really interested and willing to take action, I think that they have to see changes with their own eyes.
Last time I counted, somebody told me there was something like 147 invasive species that have been introduced to the Great Lakes. The only one, as you note in the book, that we've been able to control basically is the lamprey, which was introduced in the 1940s. Is that correct?
1930s, 1940s, yes.
There's a huge amount of money spent to control that blood-sucking parasite. Basically, it attaches to fish and just they waste away as this lamprey sucks away the blood. There's no controlling many of these invasives. So how are they affecting? You mentioned how the quagga mussel were affecting the lakes. How are these other invasives causing problems?
Well, first of all, we have to make a distinction between a non-native species and introduced species. There are approximately 180 non-native species in the Great Lakes.
And some of them we like.
Right.
Some salmon.
Of them, yeah, exactly. They've been introduced. So there's actually a rule that distinguishes between an invasive and an introduced species. For example, an introduced species would be the suckermouth minnow. It's there in the Great Lakes. It's really not having a whole lot of impact. But there are a handful of invasives that are having a huge impact, like the spiny water flea and the quagga mussel. And what we see the quagga mussels and the zebra mussels do is they're filter feeders. They sit on the bottom of the lake and they suck out the plankton. Not only have they made the water clear, but they've actually changed the water chemistry because they're using calcium. They're sucking calcium out of the water in order to make their own shells. The spiny water flea, which I find absolutely fascinating, a fascinating little creature. It's so small it could sit on the tip of your finger. But it has this barb on the end of its tail. And in order for that spiny water flea to be eaten by a fish, that fish has to be at least 20 times larger in order to digest it because that barb will otherwise puncture the fish's stomach and the fish will die. If you are a fish that is big enough to eat a spiny water flea, you're actually getting a pretty good meal. But if you're that small, you take a great risk at eating a spiny water flea. But what the spiny water flea does, it affects both the trophic level above it and the trophic level below it because it's eating everything, all the other plankton, zooplankton on that level. That means there's less zooplankton to eat the phytoplankton, and that means there's less zooplankton to be eaten by the bigger fish. Because the spiny water flea came in from Eastern Europe, it did not co-evolve with the plankton that are in the Great Lakes. And the plankton in the Great Lakes that are prey, they can detect a predator coming because they can feel a pressure wave. They can sense a chemical cue. With the spiny water flea, prey cannot detect that. And the prey is just getting wiped out by the superior predator.
We know that a lot of this has to be taken care of by government policy, but there are some things that we can do. Can you give us an idea of what anglers, for instance, or school teachers handing out rusty crayfish might do in the future to help reduce spreading some of these? You know, zebra mussel is a really good example. It started here in the Great Lakes, but it's across the entire nation now.
One of the things we can do is we can make sure that we're not transporting invasive or even, you know, just non-native species from lake to lake or location to location. We have to make sure that if we have our boat on a trailer, if we take it from one lake to another lake, we have to make sure that boat is clean and dry. We want to make sure that we're not taking any seaweed with us. That seaweed could potentially be Eurasian water milfoil. And just a tiny little fleck of that Eurasian water milfoil will go from one lake to another, fall into that other lake, and become established in the next lake. We talked a little bit about the spiny water flea a few minutes ago. Fish cannot digest, even though fish will eat spiny water flea eggs, they cannot digest spiny water flea eggs because they're in a hard case and it will pass right through a fish's digestive tract. So let's say you're an angler, you've caught a fish, you've put it in your live well, and you're going to go to another lake. There's potential there that fish is going to excrete spiny water flea eggs, and you're going to take it to the next lake and potentially spread it to that next lake. We want to make sure that when we are moving our boats that they are clean, that we have pulled those drain plugs, and that those boats are dry to make sure that we're not spreading anything to another location.
And that includes bait from one place to another, which can cause a lot of problems as well.
Absolutely, and that's one of the ways that the rusty crayfish got into the Great Lakes. Besides through classrooms, anglers were bringing them from their native area in the Ohio River, Ohio and Kentucky. I've never fished with crayfish, but I'm told that Great Lakes crayfish are not particularly good bait. So anglers will bring them the rusty crayfish up from Ohio and Kentucky. They will put a hook on it and use it as bait. And what happens at the end of the day when we're done with our bait? We just tend to dump it out into the water, thinking that, well, okay, we've got this bait. We don't no longer need it. What's the humane thing to do? We're going to put it back as a resource. Well, potentially that bait may not necessarily be from that lake. You may be introducing some kind of non-native into a new location. We all have to be aware of that.
William Rapay is the author of the book Lake Invaders, Invasive Species, and the Battle for the Future of the Great Lakes. Thanks for coming in and telling us about the book.
Thank you, Lester.